Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Greetings. We are about to get this thing on the road. The voice of freedom, the voice of reason in the house, ready to deliver it right between the eyes. And that being the truth. Listen, September 5th on Wednesday, the 5th of September, remember, we'll say, is the day that the op-ed piece by the still undiscovered, mysterious, as of, what is it now, about 10 a.m. on Friday, we still haven't figured out who the guy or gal was that wrote this article in the New York Times. Trump, as of this morning, is claiming he's going to be asking Sessions to prosecute, to find and prosecute the leaker. Now, before everybody breaks out into a sweat over this, you know, this is straight from Obama's playbook. I mean, the Obama administration, this is exactly what they did to make sure that no unflattering stories ever saw the light of day. And there's still some got out, of course, during the Obama years, but not nearly as many as now we're seeing with Trump. Part of the reason for that is a very aggressive search and destroy mission launched anytime there was a leak. The only thing that you need to really know about the article, and I tell you, I comes out and I think, all right, so what are we going to learn? This could be interesting. And everything you need to know is buried almost at the very end of the piece, which is Trump is bad. Senator John McCain is good. And at that point, I honestly felt bamboozled. Because the takeaway, of course, is that if somebody truly thinks that McCain is the lodestar, the vanguard of morality and decency in politics, they either are delusional or they're writing this piece with a little bit of throw up in their mouth. One example of this is Republicans, McCain included, fought Obamacare tooth and nail, fought the mandate. They fought it the entire time Obama was in office. Trump comes in, gets an opportunity to lose the mandate, and in a vote, who scuttles it? John McCain. Why? Did he suddenly have a light go on in his mind that socialized medicine is a great idea? No, of course not. He hates Trump, and so he's going to vote against it. In direct contravention of his stated ideals. There are other examples, tax cuts, anything with the name Trump. Did we forget all of this? So whoever is writing this article, I will tell you exactly who they are. I don't have a name. But this is the type of person that when I was at the convention, I came across on a near daily basis, near hourly basis. And let me tell you what I mean. Robbie and I, we were there. We were in Cleveland and the party was big. The party was bold and no one there, pretty much nobody there who was part of the Republican establishment. All these young faces, college Republicans who became some sort of minor functionaries within the national GOP, these people were all there at this party. And the refrain I heard over and over again was, oh, no, we don't like Trump. We don't like Trump. He's not going to win. It's terrible. I'm here for the party. I'm here for the drinks. I'm here for the fun. And we can't wait. And I heard this over and over again. People said, they literally told us, we can't wait for this nightmare of Trump to be over. Sound familiar? It's exactly what's in this piece. All these young Republican apparatchiks were excited for the prospect of Trump now losing. They were upset that he was the nominee, wanted him to lose, so they could go back to the Republican Party they love and adore, the Republican Party that is just mishmash, sloppy, who knows what, lost in the weeds, feel good with compassionate conservatives, don't want to anger our friends at CNN, and in the process, lose every freaking election that comes their way. to them, and I've said this before, to these kind of people, Trump is an existential threat. When did career politicians start to be a nice term? It started to be a nice term. People are saying McCain's years of service and lauding him, right? Okay, spent his whole life pretty much as a politician. And you get these kids, right? And I still think that this article was written by a younger person. That's my sense. And not by a cabinet member. Did you hear this? All the cabinet members are lining up and saying, "It wasn't me." And even Melania Trump had to issue a vehement denial. Like, look, it's not a senior person. And in case you're, I know the New York Times said it was a senior person, but they have a long history, my friends, of exaggerating the seniority of their anonymous sources. Okay. So I think that this was a younger person. I think this is the kind of person who has worked in perhaps a senatorial office somewhere, who has worked on Capitol Hill, who's a kind of an inside the beltway GOP hack, an aspiring congressman or congresswoman from someplace, somewhere, wherever they're from, and they're doing their time. And to them, Trump is an absolute abomination, but not because of his ideals or his ideas, which, of course, his piece impugns, saying that Trump has no moral compass. He's not tied to any particular ideology. But because Trump's very ideology is completely disruptive to their personal careers. Like, if you are a 20-something person, and you've worked, you've put your time in. You got a job maybe right out of high school as a Senate page or a congressional page. And you're not getting paid anything, but you're there, big eyes, you know, loving being inside the beltway. You see the congressmen, you know, riding their special elevators and in their offices. You go, this is going to be me someday. And so you get a permanent job somewhere. And you're not making any money, right? These jobs are terrible. And again, you're like, this is going to be me some way. And your entire way of getting to the top is to ingratiate yourself into the establishment that you believe is going to propel you to the next level, to your ultimate goal. Along comes a guy from within your own party and takes a wrecking ball to the establishment that you have put in time with, right, in hopes of that it will launch your career. What kind of hate in your heart do you have for this man? It's huge. But to you and me, to us regular Joes and Janes out there, what do we care about? We don't give a rat's rear end about some kid who wants to become a congressman. Hell's bells. You know who we want in Congress? We want a retired business owner who's actually done something real. I predict that when we find out who this person is, it's not going to be somebody with any real world bona fides. It's going to be some schmucky guy who went to, you know, George Mason University or Georgetown or whatever, some, you know, East Coast school, maybe DC school, and is an insider, GOP person, worked on Capitol Hill or similar. Right. And this is their life. And that the election of Trump is the very repudiation of this system. We're done with it. As Republicans and conservative Republicans, we're sick of this. We are sick of these losers going to Washington, promising us all the sweet nothings that we want to hear. You know, I don't know. You know, we want a better economy. We want lower taxes. We want illegal immigration fixed, a wall built. They promise all of this every 2 years and then pull the rug out from underneath us. Why? Because when they get there, they don't mean half the stuff that they say. And the most frustrating thing to me about this op-ed piece, because I really think this is the news story of the week, this piece, the most frustrating thing is calling Trump, what does he do? Let me find the exact point. The root of the problem, the story goes here, the text reads, is the president's amorality. Anyone who works with him knows he is not more to any discernible first principles that guide his decision making. Now, I don't know. I don't work with him. I'm not inside the White House. But can I tell you, just as an outsider, my impression is that unlike Bush, unlike even Clinton or Obama, and maybe closest to this Reagan, Trump is a guy who is pretty much doing everything as president that he promised to do on the trail. This criticism was my actually biggest fear going into January. I thought that Trump, in my back of my mind, I thought, you know, what if Trump really just told all of us the stuff that we wanted to hear, talked loud about, you know, taking it to China and sticking it to China, talked loud about building a wall and tamping down on illegal immigration, talked loud about being tough in the world and carrying a big stick, talked too loud about NATO and making NATO pay its fair share, just all that stuff. What if it was just talk? My biggest fear, okay, going into, you know, Inauguration Day, was that, you know, when the clock struck noon and Trump got sworn in as president, he was going to say, oh, this presidenting thing is fun. Let's go to some parties. And that he would forget the promises that he made out on the trail. These people here are seething because the exact opposite is true. They are seething because he actually turns out is moored to some principles. Now, they may not be faithfulness to his wife, but they certainly are a faithfulness to the promises that he made out on the campaign trail. So the only people that this article speaks to are the morons that already hate Trump, the people that are out there that are irrationally upset with what he's doing. Incidentally, upset with him mostly because he is fulfilling all those promises. What are people ranting about? That he lacks compassion with immigration? That he's being tough on trade, like a bull in a china shop, pun intended? This is what this is all about. So I know. They're talking about the 25th Amendment. You heard about this, yes. That he's losing his mind. That he's delusional. That he doesn't talk in coherent thoughts. That his agenda is only being achieved because why? He's surrounded by some adults in the room. You know, I actually think sometimes when you read something, what if you turn it around? What if you say that more of his agenda would have been achieved if it weren't for these so-called resisting adults in the room? What if we could have more progress than we've had if it weren't for all these smart, smart, smart people telling Trump at every turn, and quietly, oh, you know, this guy's really just, we can't say that to China. Well, why not? Trump actually may, at the end of the day, have far better instincts than all of these Beltway clowns. But my last and, you know, final thought on this subject is, whatever happened to elections? I mean, this guy writing in here is like, the sanctity of our elections. And Trump didn't take an aggressive enough stand to Russia meddling in the sanctity of our elections. These people that ramble on about the sanctity of our elections absolutely do not deserve to be heard on the subject because there's doublespeak. On one hand, Yeah, Russia, burn them to the ground for how dare they unleash bots on us during our elections. but wait a minute. Our elections elected Donald Trump. No. Illegitimate president. We got to find a way to get rid of him. 25th Amendment, whatever it takes. What is it? Yes. Nullify the vote of the people. That is the refrain. So this is not, it's just, it's nothing. They're going to find the guy. We're going to figure out who it is. And if anything, honestly, in a management perspective, this is the problem is a guy who is in there to remake a party is going to find more resistance from within, maybe than even from the outside. And that's what you're seeing. And in my view, it's a good thing. It means he is actually doing what he promised and taking fire to these, to this political underbelly that has delivered nothing but empty, broken promises to us, the conservative Republican base. All right, don't go anywhere. Sam Rogowski back right after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Jobs report out today, a plus 201,000 jobs across the United States. I saw somebody, the bumper sticker, the Trump economy doing so well, even Kaepernick has a job. It's working. And you also have to ask yourself, you know, our unemployment rate was at 10%. During Obama's recession in 2010, 10%. And we're down to 3.9% unemployment now at the tail end of 2018. Now, I'm going to tell you why, because you're going to what you hear a lot of people there who, you know, are left leaning economists have all sorts of ways of explaining this. And Obama is out there. You heard he's back on the campaign trail, him and Michelle stumping for congressional Democrats, looking to beat Republicans in tight races. So they're out there on the campaign trail. And Obama's whining that he's not getting enough credit for the economy. One of the principal reasons that the economy crashed back in 2010 was because of Obama's policy, and not just his policies, but his rhetoric. You had a president that went around town saying, "You didn't build it. Don't go to Vegas. Don't spend money. Banks are evil. Capitalism is, well, it's tolerable, but we need to kind of contain it. You know, we need to regulate it because that's going to make everything better." And words matter. If you don't think words matter, look at Tesla's stock price today. Elon Musk goes on and does a podcast or YouTube video, whatever the hell it was, smoking pot, talking nonsense about being an alien from an outer planet. And immediately, right, Tesla stock goes down. When you have a CEO of a company talking drivel, their company stock price goes down. When you have a sitting U.S. president espousing Marxist beliefs the way Obama did, in the first two, what happened? 2008, he comes into office, ran as essentially a socialist. We didn't talk much during the campaign, but we know from his background he was. And as soon as he begins speaking as president, careful, regulate. The economy explodes, implodes, starts going down in a hail of fire. What's the Obama administration answer? It's because there wasn't enough regulation. When you contrast that to the words of Trump, and I know everybody gets fixated on the crazy tweets, but Trump is consistent, 100% consistent on things that the marketplace is looking for. And businesses are absolutely, and I'm telling you this as a business owner, people are more likely to hire when they sense that there's going to be a business-friendly administration there to help them. You know, employers, by the way, jobs are a big test of company confidence in the economy. Because what you do when you hire a person, that is an expensive liability. Hiring people, you don't realize, but you know, when your employer hires you, it's a risk, right? I mean, you maybe won't do your job well. There's going to be, it's going to take you a while. It'll take you a few months before you understand really what you're doing, before you present a real value to your employer in some cases, right? You could also end up being a nut job and blow the place up. So every time a guy, a business hires you or hires me, they're taking on a certain risk and they're doing it, and they're more likely to do it when they sense that there is an economy that's going to go up. And they sense that an economy is going to go up, one that they can take advantage of and make a rapacious profit off of. And they have that feeling. They have that feeling because they hear a guy in the White House talking about, no, it's yours. You built it. You're a business guy. Do it. Let's make America great again. Meanwhile, everybody at the New York Times and elsewhere is poo-pooing it as nationalist rhetoric. I'll tell you who's not poo-pooing it. The people that are spending money in this economy. So to the New York Times and other people in the mainstream media, put up or shut up, because you guys are just writing words. Other people out there, they're spending money. Who am I going to believe? I'm going to believe the people spending money. Okay, you don't want to miss our Is It Legal segment. It involves a beaver that was abused in a heinous way that may or may not have resulted in its death. A host of legal issues ensued. I will break it down for you. I'm going to really try to sanitize this. I promise. No, I will. I will. I'll make this as clean of a story as I possibly can. Hide your children. Sam Rogowski, back right after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam Rogowski. You'll find him very interesting. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Breaking rocks in a hot sun. I'm on the law in a low one.
Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, spread the word. The podcast, downloadable every week on iTunes and elsewhere. Easy to get, and so much information here. So tell a friend. Don't let your friends go without. Yeah. Well, now let's talk about our legal conundrum here. There was an article that came out in Newsweek on Wednesday, the title of which was, I would say, somewhat captivating. The headline reads, Washington man sexually assaults injured beaver as woman tries to save it. Now, I, your host, was immediately intrigued, and I had to read more. Bemused, I think, by maybe some unintentional double entendre that was sure to be at play. The story reads as follows. Quote, according to KXLY, a woman saw a driver run a beaver over. Now, this, friends, is referring to an animal. Okay. Had to make that clear. She wrapped it, meaning the beaver, in a towel and rushed home for a box to aid the injured animal. I'm going to add some little color commentary here. This is Washington State. People are very earthy. They see injured beavers. They immediately rush to aid and comfort these animals. So, okay. So the woman leaves. Quote, but when she returned half an hour later, she saw a man lying next to the beaver with his pants unzipped. At first, she thought the man was trying to help the beaver. When she saw him lying with it, then she realized what was really going on. Close quote. Now, by the time the cops show up, the beaver's dead. And the guy gets arrested, all right? He gets arrested, first-degree animal cruelty, possession of controlled substance, because it might surprise you that he also had some meth on him. Here's why I'm bringing this up in our legal segment. There was a fascinating case back in 1996 that this all reminded me of. And there was a guy who was charged with having intercourse with a dead deer. The article at the time had an equally captivating headline reading, Probation for Bambi Molester. Now, this case happened up in Wisconsin and resulted in some very interesting legal jurisprudence. This is fancy talk for lawyers opining about things, taking it to a judge, and the judge coming down with the decision. And the crux of the case, friends, was, are you allowed to have sex with a dead animal? Now, I bring it up because that was the defense that the guy used in the case. The guy, in this case, back in 96, basically said, hey, you need to let me free. The statute says you can't do things to animals. And since Webster Dictionary defines animals as all things living in the animal kingdom or whatever it is, let me see here. Any of a kingdom of living beings, quote unquote, as long as the animal isn't alive, you're scot-free. Well, the judge wrote this four-page opinion that is absolutely out of this world brilliant. And I don't know. I think this is all interesting stuff. What I love about law is it will take some very sensational topics and distill them into just core root simple facts. And that's exactly what happened here. It got into the meaning of the statute. And this is very interesting because it said, look, yes, on one hand, we get it. Merriam-Webster, whatever, they come out with the definition of what it means to be an animal. But to say that the law is vague, okay, or unspecific, you can take that to an absurd conclusion, like basically saying that people are animals too because we're all things living. The statute means what it means. It means animals. And the second part of it was, oh, this is really interesting. It basically said, look, the statute in Wisconsin, and incidentally, the law in California is very similar. It has to do with parts of the animal that can be used for sexual gratification. And as long as that animal has those characteristics, you can't, do stuff with those parts. So the law actually came down that the line is not at the time of death, right? This animal alive, animal dead, that's your discernible line. But actually, it has to do with if the animal still has all those characteristics, if it has certain orifices intact, doesn't matter that it's dead, it's still an animal for the purposes of this statute. I love that the people in Washington State just got around the whole thing and made it about animal cruelty, which is, I think, the right way to charge this, because also it's a felony. And in most states, believe it or not, most states, intercourse with animals is just a misdemeanor. Oh, I know. No, listen, preparing for this segment put some very awful things in my browser history. So I'd like to just point out to my wife that, Sherry, yeah, this was all work related. All right. Sam Rajofsky back after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rajofsky, Sam Nation. I forgot to add that the relevant statute, the felony first degree animal cruelty punishment in Washington State for this man, Richard Martin Delp, who was caught cavorting with said beaver, includes the following punishments. One, it has a 2-year jail sentence, up to a 2-year jail sentence. Two, a fine that starts at $1,000. And three, the forfeiture of animals that are in possession of the perpetrator. So if any of you are wondering of how the beaver was disposed of, it was clearly forfeited after the act, making it the last beaver he'll ever have. Now, as we had this... meanwhile, Democrats busy screwing the pooch up in Washington. How's that for a transition? Guy, I've been watching for you. I've been putting my time in. Observing the Kavanaugh hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I have to tell you right now, I'm reporting back that Kavanaugh is doing splendidly. This in spite of his obvious limitations of being a white male with a frat boy first name. Kavanaugh's great quality, and you need this if you're going to be a Supreme Court judge. You've got to be mellow. So I'm going to tell you, first of all, he's an intellectual guy, clearly very bright, but he is unflappable. I remember seeing this, being greatly taken by it, when John Roberts was being confirmed to replace Justice Rehnquist. And they came at him. This was during the Bush years. Remember, this is when Democrats hated Bush and not Trump. And Bush was the great Satan back then. And so they were coming at him with all the usual stuff. It was the same thing. Roberts just all he did was blink. Alito didn't even blink, but Roberts blinked and just came back with the most pleasant of responses. And that's what Kavanaugh's been doing. Very tactful, very specific. And by the way, when you engage in political grandstanding with a legal whiz and you want to get a point across as a Democrat, the legal whiz, because to every legal question, the answer is always, we joke about this in law school, the answer is always, it depends. It depends. Lawyers will always say, it depends. Well, okay, you're giving me a premise, but there are these other four factors that weigh on how I'm going to answer. And so when you are a Supreme Court nominee, you have two objectives. One objective is to not answer the freaking question if it's a hostile question. But the other objective is to show off also your legal bona fides, to show off how smart you are. Well, what better opportunity than to answer every question posed to you with a, well, it depends, and here are the factors I would have to look at, and these are the other things. And by the time you're done answering the question, the entire point and purpose to the Democrats sitting there grilling you of where they were going with their point is lost. And you just look like an unflappable genius. Why am I telling you this? Simple. Every effort the Democrats have been trying to make at cornering Brett Kavanaugh has just resulted in making him look smarter and more even keel. And so all of this is backfiring spectacularly. Now, right away on Tuesday morning, the fireworks began. This is classic. Senator Grassley, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, starts giving his opening remarks. And listen to what Kamala Harris, Mazie Hirono, and Blumenthal start interrupting. Listen to this.
Good morning. I welcome everyone to this confirmation hearing on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh.
Mr. Chairman.
To serve as Associate Justice.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be recognized for a question before we proceed.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
We cannot possibly move forward, Mr. Chairman.
I extend a very warm welcome to Judge Kavanaugh.
We have not been given an opportunity to have a meaningful hearing on the nominee.
Their two daughters.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with my colleague, Senator Harris, and we believe this hearing should be postponed.
I know this is an exciting day for all of you here, and you're rightly proud.
Chairman, if
the American people,
Mr. Chairman, I move to adjourn
directly.
We have been denied real access to the documents we need to advise.
Mr. Chairman, regular order is called for,
which turns this hearing into a charade and a mockery of our norm.
This is a mockery and a tragedy of justice. This is a tragedy of justice. We will not go back. Cancel Brett Kavanaugh.
All right. So basically, that's what it sounded like right out of the gate. I think Grassley just turned off his hearing aid. Just and off. Sam Rejofsky back right after this. More on this. I've got more clips. Good stuff. Don't go anywhere.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rejofsky. Now, what Sam is. is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Rejofsky. Okay, so just a quick recap of how the Tuesday morning session, opening session, the hearing, confirmation hearing from Brett Kavanaugh, Trump's Supreme Court justice nominee, began. You'll hear that, I mean, Senator Grassley doesn't even have time to get out Kavanaugh's name, and he's got Kamala Harris jumping all over him. Here's just the beginning of the clip I played right before the break.
Good morning. I welcome everyone to this confirmation hearing on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh.
Mr. Chairman.
To serve as Associate Justice.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like
Supreme
to be recognized for a question before we proceed.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
We cannot possibly move.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so you get it. Okay, so that's it. I mean, she just starts talking over him. And you don't do this in the Senate. I want to point that out, too. This is not common practice. But my favorite thing from this is that, the intrepid journalists over at CNN obviously missed the entire open lead story of all this, because this went down on Tuesday as a recap of the events. And this was the lead with Jake Tapper, no less, on CNN. Listen.
Look, I think the Democrats were extremely respectful today in the hearing. They were simply asking for, under regular order, please, Mr. Chairman, let's delay, let's get the documents. We feel like we don't have enough information to be able to effectively advise and consent on this issue.
This is all nonsense. Why? I mean, nothing was respectful about that. It was it's a joke. But the entire idea about these documents, right, that they don't have enough documents. I mean, all the Democrats want to do is stall this. And they're using the same tactics that they use time in and time out. And by the way, one of the things that came out in the testimony over and over again was there are senators there, Republican senators, that have been sitting in their seats for over 20 years. They've confirmed who? Sonia Sotomayor. They've confirmed perhaps distasteful, politically distasteful people that they haven't liked. But they voted for them and treated them with respect. You get a guy... Love him or hate him, you get a guy like Lindsey Graham there. And this is not how he behaves. We look as a state, I'm going to tell you, I mean, Kamala Harris makes us look so bad. It's so tacky. Now, the other part of this that was hilarious was Cory Booker decided to become Spartacus. Yes, a rebel slave. And had a Spartacus moment. He told people it was a Spartacus moment. What was this? He claimed that he had these documents, smoking gun documents, where Brett Kavanaugh talks about racial profiling. And here is what he is saying about violating the confidentiality rules, because all these documents, according to Booker, were confidential, were classified, and could not be released.
I knowingly violated the rules that were put forth, and I'm told that the committee confidential rules have knowing consequences. And so, sir, I come from a long line, as all of us do as Americans, and understand what that kind of civil disobedience is, and I understand the consequences. So I am right now, before your process is finished, I'm going to release the email about racial profiling. And I understand that the penalty comes with potential ousting from the Senate. And if Senator Cornyn believes that I violated Senate rules, I openly invite and accept the consequences of my team releasing that email right now.
Oh, a martyr is born. But wait, not so fast. It turned out that just that very morning, the people that controlled the document made it public, or made it open for release. So in the end, he is lying. He is bold-faced lying to get on TV and sound like he's a martyr. And he even gets called on it by Anderson Cooper. Cooper says to him, hey, but wait, was it really a violation? Because at this point, you know, President Bush's presidential records representative said he cleared the documents before 4 a.m. per your staff's request. Democrats. All right, when we come back, there's a big issue brewing right now. Part of what this program, what we like to do, is not just react to the news of the day, but get ahead of some big issues. One of the big issues is the question of censorship on social media. We got a lot of Republicans, a lot of conservatives out there right now that are getting burned, that are getting crisped up by Twitter and the like. Some are getting banned outright. It's a timely issue. We had some testimony happen on Capitol Hill. But I am interested sort of in the big picture here, and I want to talk about that a little bit because I think I have a unique take that I haven't heard other people really get into. So I'll be back right after this with that. Don't go anywhere. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
We shall fight on the airwaves. We shall fight on Twitter and Facebook. We shall broadcast our program, whatever the cost may be. And if Sam Nation lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour.
Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, rarely wrong, always right, giving you analysis steps ahead of the mainstream chatter here on the Sam Nation radio program. All right. Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and others are banning conservative voices. Now, they're kind of, for first of the first issue is, assuming that some content-specific banning is occurring. And it seems from everything that I've read that that's happening. It's happening, and I've noticed on Twitter, for example, people, conservatives who had had a large number of followers, suddenly they're dropping and dropping and dropping, and it's because their tweets are being, for whatever reason, are being deprioritized in whatever algorithm displays that information. And given that Twitter and other of these platforms, you have followers that are always coming and going, right? People that are, you know, are signing up basically to follow your feed and then at the same time simultaneously leaving. You always have to have an influx of new eyeballs to continue your numbers up or to at least maintain the numbers that you have. So I say this, that when you see numbers dropping in terms of number of followers, it does portend to explain that your new tweets, your timely tweets, your kind of cutting edge information is somehow being deprioritized. Now, the question is, for me always first, is it legal? And I approach it two ways. I approach things from a philosophical viewpoint that is rooted in the Constitution. And then I have to say, all right, and now I know what the Constitution says, but now how have the courts bastardized it, right? How have the courts modified it? So what is actually existing law? And the answer here, the takeaway here, may actually surprise you. So let's unpackage this. I'll first tell you what I think. I think that private property rights are sacrosanct. I am of the opinion that the Fifth Amendment in the Bill of Rights is very specific about private property. The founders wanted us to have private property rights. And the very last line of the Fifth Amendment reads, private property shall not be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, what does that mean? Well, yeah, no, it means the way people most often understand this takings clause, right, is eminent domain. The ability of the state to, for example, take your house. If your house is the one house or one of five houses in the way of a freeway that needs to be built, there is an ability for the government to come in and take your house. for the sake of everyone's good, right? We all need the freeway. So you need to be compensated, but it's only in that type of an extreme setting. Now, you and I understand by virtue of this complex economy that we live in that private property does not just mean a house. It doesn't just mean earth underfoot. Private property extends to other things. And websites, in my view, are private property. For example, if you have a website like Facebook, the real estate on Facebook, what appears on that site belongs to who? Facebook. You acknowledge this, by the way, when you go on Facebook and you load up personal pictures of yourself, your family, your kids. One of the things that you're signing away is now that all becomes property of Facebook. And it is no different of a legal concept than if you build yourself a little house on somebody else's land. Or if you, in the course and scope of renting an apartment from, let's say, a big landlord or a small landlord, it doesn't matter, install something in that apartment, it becomes part of the real property. It changes characteristics from being your property, your chattel property, your movable thing you have now installed into real property, and it's changed characteristics and it's changed owners. The same is true for when you put up anything on Facebook. Why? It all traces back to our founders. It traces back actually to Madison's Federalist Papers. And when you read what was written back then, you realize that the protection of property was an essential government function, that the government, the founders believed that the government really owed a duty to all of us as individual rapacious capitalists to protect our lucre. If you think that this is, by the way, an inessential government function, well, my friends, look no further than South America, where from government to government, based on changing political tides, there are changing attitudes about the role the government plays in protecting private property. And as a consequence, there is no stability financially because people don't believe in investing in property. They fear that with the next changing political tide, the property will vanish and disappear. Venezuela. Now, given this, I personally, fundamentally believe that if Facebook wants to kill conservatives on their website, they're free to do so. And I'm directly at odds with many conservatives out there who are screaming and shouting about this as being some form of censorship. Censorship, okay? First Amendment law, I don't think applies here. The First Amendment applies only to government regulation of speech. If you come to my house and start telling me about how great communism is, I'm going to kick you out. And as long as I don't actually kick you, I'm free to do so. But there is interesting case law given to us by none other than the Rehnquist Court that I think will come back and bite liberals, because it was the left, ironically, that brought this very famous case forward that will become again relevant in this fight if conservatives actually get their, you know, stuff together and mount a legal challenge to Twitter and to Facebook. I think they have a legal leg to stand on. Now, I'm going to ask you, before I get into it, let me ask you something. Where do you think, have you been to a shopping center recently? You've been to the mall? Anywhere. Any mall. Small mall, strip mall, whatever. Okay. And have you ever come across some, I don't know, maybe a table that is set up, some people, you know, some Jehovah's Witnesses, or maybe some people signing some petitions. Greenpeace, there's a mall that little strip mall I go to here in Orange County, kind of a hippie place. And every time I get out of the car there, I get a couple of Greenpeace people accost me. And there I am getting out of, you know, my gas guzzling beast of a car, dressed in my, you know, Mr. Capitalist uniform, white shirt, red tie, blue suit. And I just laugh. I go, you really, really? Me? Move along. Get out of my way. But there's always a sign. Maybe you haven't noticed this, but you'll notice it now. Almost every shopping center where you have one of these things, booths or whatever, people standing set up, they have a sign. And the sign basically says, we, owners of the shopping center, are really, really sorry that you have to deal with these bozos. Now, I'm making some of this up, but essentially, that you have to deal with these guys because, but we are bound by current law to allow them onto our premises. Sorry for the inconvenience. And that's the sign that goes up. The law that that sign references is called the Pruneyard case. And this was a case, I've talked about it before on the program, Pruneyard versus Robbins. Now, Robbins was one guy of many. They actually were protesting Israel, I believe. And this was back in 1977 or 74. I forget what year it was. But anyway, they were protesting Israel. They were libs. They were libs protesting Israel on private property here in California. And the shopping center says, you know what? Great. We love that you guys don't like Israel, but excuse me, would you please go stand on the street right outside on public property? We don't want you here at our mall. The case went up to the California Supreme Court. Now, there was a part of the California Constitution that allowed for this type of activity to occur, that allowed for people to exercise their free speech rights in shopping centers and other places open to large amounts of the public. And the case ended up going all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that the California law was constitutional. And the holding in that case basically is that if a state has this in their constitution, it's permissible. And that private property owners, such as, let's say I'm going to name a mall here in Orange County, South Coast Plaza, owned by the Segerstrom family, the Segerstrom family cannot bar some radical, you know, fascists from setting up a booth inside their mall. I remember, well, they can't. They have to allow them as long as they're not getting in the way of their customers. But it's the holding. It's always the text of the case. Are you following, by the way, where this is headed? See, how is a shopping center, I'm asking this, how is a shopping center different from, I don't know, a website like Facebook? They're both private property, but they're also both open to the public. And one of the things that the court reasoned, in the Rehnquist opinion, Rehnquist wrote the main opinion in the case, and one of the things that he said in it is shopping centers have become, this is in 1980, right? And so you can imagine that America was changing. We were no longer the Main Street kind of small town USA place. People now were congregating in shopping centers. And so the theory or the rationalization went that since people are no longer hanging out in public squares, but we're instead congregating in these malls and in these, you know, places that were open up to large amounts of public coming in, that these malls, in fact, have become the new public squares. And as such, for the government to not allow for private property owners to ban speech would be to eliminate bad public policy. It would eliminate free speech or the exchange of ideas within our society. This is what we call judicial activism. When you hear that term, you hear the law being contorted in a way, changed in a way to fit some ideal. We call that public policy. That is literally judges creating law and stretching the Constitution to make for, you know, something that it's not. And I'll tell you why this bothers me so much in the context of this shopping center case. I was one time at that mall, South Coast Plaza here in Orange County, and I was eating at a French restaurant that was serving foie gras. Now, if you don't know what that is, Foie gras is a goose liver, duck liver. What is it, Robbie? Goose? Goose. They fatten the goose up. They do terrible things to the goose. Not as bad as what happened to the beaver on the side of the road in Washington, but close. They force feed the goose. They keep it stuck in a little cage. They fatten its liver up, and then the unthinkable happens. The goose is killed. And the whatever, the foie gras, it's served. And then you remember it was banned in California, now it's back. Well, I was leaving this restaurant, and by incidentally, friends, I hate foie gras. It's disgusting. If you really want my honest opinion, it's gross. But I was leaving this restaurant, and there was this protest outside the restaurant, but inside the mall. And they were allowed to be there. And I'm going to tell you that if you want freaky protesters, it's the animal rights people. These people are freaks. They are dangerous. They are angry. And they basically want to kill you because they see you as a murderer. And I was leaving this restaurant and the people were, I mean, it was hot. Now, I'm going to ask you, if you are the owner of a mall, does that turn away business? In my view, it does. In my view, that restaurant that pays rent to the mall suffered that day. And under the terms of a general revenue sharing rent agreement, which most restaurants have in malls, that mall suffered a loss, not just the restaurant, but the mall. That month that they protested there, the mall lost revenue. And in that sense, I think it's a taking. I think that the government allowing free speech to occur inside a mall, even if that speech is totally hostile to the business interests of the entity of the mall, then it creates what? Malls only make money when people are there. If people don't want to be there because they feel awkward and they feel imposed upon, then they want to leave, right? They don't spend money. Now, how does all of this relate to Facebook? Well, when we come back, I'm going to explain this because I think that the libs rejoiced over this case and they think, yes, we got one past that fool Rehnquist. Yes, yes, yes. This is exactly right. We finally, those nice protesters, those nice kids, Model United Nations kids that were telling the world about how evil Israel is, they get to speak. And now the same people are saying, whoa, 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 whoa. Twitter's a private company. It's private. It's private. There's nothing to do with First Amendment. Government can't. Blah, blah, blah. And I think they're screwed. So more on this when we come back. Sam Rogowski on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation live. Well, alive at least, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. So, I know I'm getting into some deep law here, but I think this is going to become a lead story in the coming months and years. So giving you a little glimpse into the future. This case, Pruneyard Shopping Center versus Robbins. If it weren't for this case, I think Twitter, I think Google, I think certainly Facebook would have a great defense to all these conservatives claiming that they're being banned. And that is, we're a private company and we don't have to provide any space for you to speak. But there's actually, straight from the decision itself, I'm going to tell you here what the holding is. And this is straight from the case. Now, just think here. Let's just put in, instead of shopping center, I'm going to read straight from the text so I don't get accused of misstating the law. But this is a holding. And I want you to just think of this as Facebook instead of shopping center. So the quote is, this is written by Justice Rehnquist back in 1980. The shopping center, by choice of its owner, is not limited to the personal use of appellants. Okay? So the personal use of the shopping center. And the views expressed by members of the public in passing out pamphlets or seeking signatures for a petition thus will not likely be identified with those of the owner. Furthermore, no specific message is dictated by the state to be displayed, and appellants are free to publicly disassociate themselves from the views of the speakers or handbillers. Well, this is exactly what we have here with Facebook. They're not Facebook's views. They're not when Alex Jones says crazy things on Twitter, everybody knows it's not Twitter. They know it's Alex Jones. But Alex Jones, if he were saying these things in a public square, nobody could shut him up because the government cannot act to stop the First Amendment. This case expanded First Amendment free speech protections to people in limited cases on private property. And in my view, it's analogous. It's similar to the internet. Where in 1980, the world shifted from us hanging out in parks, you know, city parks, and suddenly we're all hanging out in shopping centers. Now, today, where are we having discourse? Well, hell, nobody's going to shopping centers anymore. Those are going bust. So what's the new thing? The internet. We're going to the internet. And these companies are going, whoa, 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 we're private property. Alex Jones, you're banned. So-and-so, I don't want to hear from you. Fine, okay. But where are we supposed to go to exchange ideas? Where are we supposed to, I don't know, evolve as a republic? We talk about this idea of talking amongst ourselves and exchanging ideas. It's extremely dangerous. Now, I'm telling you, you got to understand the First Amendment is about free speech as it relates to government control of speech. That only applies to where the government is doing, whether it's a city, a state, or the federal government doing something to prevent you from speaking. But I'm telling you, as long as it's a private company, they can do it if it weren't for this original case back in 1980. Now, the most interesting thing is, and this is when people tell me, oh, the founders, they didn't know anything. They had no idea, Sam. The Constitution is a living document. You heard that before? In Federalist 10, Madison made a very important point, and that's he talked about factions. And he talked about factions as it related to property rights. And he said basically that rights have to be commonly threatened by faction are the rights of property. And I would add to this that right now you've got a lot of conservatives out there who are claiming we deserve to be able to speak on Facebook. We demand to be able to speak on Twitter. And it's one faction versus another faction. And who's the loser in this? The loser in this is if conservatives prevail here, it further erodes our private property rights, in my view. But unfortunately, this is a consequence of judicial activism. When you contort the Constitution to fit your political views, or you fit some sort of ideal that you have as a judge, you're screwed. And this is, by the way, why Kavanaugh is going to make such a great justice, because from everything that he's been saying this week, he's very strict about looking at the law and looking at the plain letter of the law. And I like that. I think it's good. All right, Friday Funny up next. Don't go anywhere. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Majowski. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
It's Friday, which means Friday funny time here on Sam Nation. All right, this story from Bridgeport, Connecticut. They had a power outage. Now, that's pretty normal, right? We get those from time to time. It was dark. A woman at home by herself needed to find a candle. I don't know why she wasn't looking for a flashlight. Who doesn't have a flashlight? The problem is this woman didn't have a candle either. Instead, she lit a stick of dynamite in her hand, blowing her hand pretty much all the way off. This is actually sad. Who has dynamite in the house? But not a flashlight, right? What kind of alt-right survivalist is this person? Yeah, what? Right? She was probably flashing some white power signs at Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing. This story reminds me of one of the stupidest things I have ever done. Brett, Robbie, do you know where I'm going with this? So it's back to school time. You know, kids are starting new schools. And I remember when I was, this was back in 1992, the summer of 92, I was transitioning. I have to qualify that now. Transitioning from grade school to middle school. Now, this is a big move. And my parents wanted to prepare me for it wisely. So the summer before I was to start the seventh grade, they thought it would be a good idea for me to go to summer school at my future, middle school and kind of learn some stuff, right? Get a lay of the land. And I was also a terrible student. And so I needed help all around. Well, it turned out I was an idiot on top of it because when I got there and I was in summer school, I didn't know anybody. And I was bored and I was walking out behind the school. This is in Irvine. I was walking out behind the school and I found this Tupperware container. And so I got this Tupperware container and the Tupperware container had an antenna sticking out of it. And inside the Tupperware container was some like firecrackers. This is how I perceived it. Now I saw this. And I immediately was intrigued by this device. And I thought, this is something I've got to check out. So what are you supposed to do? Kids, if you're listening, what are you supposed to do? Well, do as I say, not as I do. Because here's what I did. I thought this device needed to immediately be brought to the attention of the authorities. Now, when you're 12, the authorities are the people in the office, right? The old lady sitting behind the counter. So I immediately took this device and carried it into the office because naturally that's what you do. I put it up on the counter. And I still remember the counter being quite high. You know, I hadn't hit a growth spurt yet. And so the counter was quite high. I remember kind of looking over the counter and And I said, hey, I found this in the back. And the lady was typing on a typewriter back then, and didn't look up and say, yeah, just leave it there. I'll show the principal. I'm walking out the door when kaboom, and the thing went off. For the balance of my career at Rancho San Joaquin Middle School, there was a crater, a black sort of soot-filled crater on the, you know, the Formica countertop that they had. And but I'm getting ahead of myself. I hear behind me, that's him. That's the guy. I didn't even know what a Darwin Award was back then, but certainly I would have qualified for one if that had gone off in my hands. I still can't believe I wasn't arrested. In today's world, it would have been a full-on police investigation. Some eighth grader, juvenile delinquent eighth grader, was laughing to some classmates a couple hours later about how he had put this thing in the back of the school, and some stupid like seventh grader had carried it into the office, and they were all laughing about it. Teacher overheard them and brought the guy in, and he's the one who ended up getting in more trouble than me. But I don't know if my parents are hearing the story for the first time, if they remember this, but anyway. Oh, I barely survived my childhood. I really barely did. So, by the grace of God, I'm here. If the power goes out, please make sure it's not dynamite that you're lighting, okay? Sam Rogowski back right after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rogowski, one of the interesting things coming out of this Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearing is one of his former clerks was accused of flashing a white power sign. You hear about this? Yeah. Well, okay. Well, so there, behind him, you saw this this gal. Her name's Zina Bush. She's married to a U.S. attorney, a federal prosecutor right down in Texas. And she's his former clerk when he was as a circuit court judge. And anyway, she's behind him. There's a handful of people when the camera is on the nominee, the guy getting grilled, in this case, Brett Kavanaugh. You can see, you know, maybe one or two people to his right and one or two people to his left. And she's prominently behind him supporting her former boss. Now, she's resting her, arm. She's got her arms kind of folded, right? And as it is, in plain view of the camera at one point, is doing one of these okay signs, right? You know what I'm talking about, where you put your index finger and your thumb together to form a circle. And, you know, if you've got five fingers, the remaining three fingers are outstretched. So, well, I mean, some people don't. Yeah, well, yeah, that's right, because they use dynamite instead of candles. Idiots. Anyway, so she's got this OK sign. Can you picture it? She's resting basically an OK sign on the crux of her elbow. All right. Well, the internet went wild, right? All this because this now is supposedly, according to the alt left, an alt right white power sign. I did a little bit of research into this. And the story is actually a lot funnier than because everybody's like, is she a racist? No, she's not a racist because, you know, in fact, I love this is how we prove that we're not racist, right? She's actually of Mexican heritage and Jewish heritage on her mother's and father's sides. So naturally, she can't be a white power person because her grandparents died in the Holocaust. And by the way, she's brown. How is this logical? Well, oh, yeah, but okay, because if you're not from Mexico, and if you happen to be, let's say, a Jehovah's Witness, then by all means, you might very, very well be a white power person. The real story here is that the entire idea of the OK sign being a white power symbol got started as a hoax. And it was started by conservatives who were so over it being called racist and everything that they thought, let's take a totally banal, normal, everyday expression, right? Okay, there's like three signs that I use. One is my thumb up, thumbs up. The other one is the middle finger up, okay? And the third one is the okay sign. Those are like, that's my sign language. What can I tell you? So they took this sign. Well, the thumbs up, they couldn't do much with. The middle finger, you know, that's a tricky one. So they did the okay sign, and they basically created a post. They created a post on something called 4chan. And in it, and this was all a mockery. I mean, it says basically, we must flood Twitter and other social media websites with spam, claiming that the okay hand sign is a symbol of white supremacy. And it goes on saying exactly how they're going to do it and how they're going to con the mainstream media into picking up the story. They actually even used a diagram. They show Mel Gibson with his hand up doing an okay sign. This is so absurd. Hey, okay. And they the OK sign, you have the three with your pinky, ring finger, middle finger up. That's a W, right? That's the W for white. And the OK, that's a P. In there is a P. White, P for power. Is everybody following me here? Well, the media totally bought into it. This is why the Russian bots are so effective at fooling the American public, because a couple of jerks on 4chan can totally spread this like wildfire. But you know what? Make no mistake, it was a lead story because race was at the forefront of the attention of the media. Here's Chris Cuomo talking to Seth Meyers on Wednesday about race and Brett Kavanaugh.
We are not united by many things in this country culturally, right? We all come from different places. Even English is a borrowed language for just about all of us. But law is our religion. That is the set of rules that we go by that create our culture. Judges, you stack the courts across this country with white, male, young judges, and you will have a generation of a certain kind of jurisprudence.
Racist law, it's coming to a courthouse near you. Sam Rajowski, back after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rajowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
What do you make of Nike using poor Mr. Kaepernick as the face of its new campaign? I have some thoughts on this. Well, of course Nike can do whatever it wants. And I actually think that controversy in a case like this helps push a product. I do. I think that this was a smart business decision. I remember, you know, the day that campaign came out, there were all these pictures of people burning their Nike gear. And it was all really old stuff. You know, they were like, burning these baggy pants from the early 90s, scrunchy waists. I'm like, look, if that's the last time you bought Nike product, I don't think Nike's sad to lose you. Now, I've observed, you know, anywhere from people saying, I'm going to buy nothing but Nike products now, to people saying, oh, that's it. Boycott, boycott, boycott. It's not going to work. The reason it's not going to work is because conservatives are not as nutty as liberals. Conservatives are going to go on with their lives, and we're so used to being told that we're stupid and that our ideas don't matter and that the other side knows better, that we're just going to tune this out. Nobody cares. If we like the shoes, we're going to buy the shoes. And you know, I'm a runner, and I know I don't wear Nikes, but because they're not good for my feet. But I do know people who swear by Nike shoes, for example, for running and other sports. And so they're not going to a person who, you know, who's running half marathons or full marathons and suddenly going to go, well, you know, I'm going to switch to a different shoe that doesn't hurt my knees or potentially hurts my knees because I'm going to screw Nike because they picked Kaepernick. But ESPN host Stephen Smith said something very interesting on Tuesday, which I actually think is unusually insightful for ESPN. Have a listen.
Unfortunately, I think it'll help the Nike brand. But the reason why I use the word unfortunate is because I don't know if anybody's gotten this. Nike essentially hijacked this issue. They have now made themselves, instead of Colin Kaepernick, the face of all of this. And you know, you can look at it and you can say, well, Colin Kaepernick taking a knee and Colin Kaepernick has a collusion case against the National Football League and what have you. But Nike essentially hijacked the entire movement, because by doing this and commemorating Colin Kaepernick, we're going to find ourselves talking more about Nike now than we are about Colin Kaepernick, than we are about the protest.
This is half true. It's a very good, pithy, half true point. But the other half that's missing from this, and he can't, the host here, I don't know who this guy is, Stephen Smith, he can't see the other part of this issue, which is by trading in this supposedly deeply personal, conviction-based, principled stand that Kaepernick was taking. By taking this protest of his and commercializing it, he's selling out. He's going to be perceived as a sellout. It's no longer serious. He's going to make money off of it. And it delegitimizes, in my view, Kaepernick's supposed entire raison d'etre. So I actually think that if you think that Colin Kaepernick is a tool, and if you think that he's a cop-hating jerk, and if you think that he's an un-American, ungrateful turd, this is a great thing because he's really delegitimized himself and sold out to the man, a.k.a. Nike, Inc. All right, we're done. I can't believe 2 hours flew by like that. Have a great weekend, guys. Enjoy. Be safe. And I'll be back here next Friday. Sam Rogowski, over now.